Go ahead and turn to Matthew 27 as we continue talking about the trials of Jesus leading up to his crucifixion. Now, does anybody remember how many trials I said there were? Yep, seven trials. What was the first trial? The trial alone in Gethsemane. How many trials were there before the Jewish authorities? Three of them. And so how many were there before the Roman authorities? Three of them. We are in the third trial before Pontius Pilate. Can you give me, after Gethsemane, give me the list of trials in order? So the first trial was before, Annas, then Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, and then the third one. Exactly, the one first thing in the morning that was legal. Then the first Roman trial was Pontius Pilate. The second one was Herod. And the third one was Pilate. So we got Annas, Caiaphas, and the Sanhedrin. Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin after the sun rose to make it legal. Pontius Pilate. Then Herod. Herod trial was just Herod wanted to see a miracle and Jesus didn't comply in any way. And so they mocked him and beat him and sent him back to Pilate. And then the third trial of Pilate is where we are now. Now, we talked about all the illegalities of the Jewish trial. The Roman trial, because Jesus was not a Roman citizen, but he was a subject of the Roman government, he didn't have the same kind of protections that a citizen would have had. And so, really, Pilate and Herod could do pretty much as they wanted in the trials and the hearings, and there was really no repercussions, there was no law that governed how they were to treat Jesus, except for there was one particular thing that Pilate did, and actually did repeatedly, that made his condemnation of Jesus illegal. Does anybody remember what that was? Yeah, he said, I found no fault with him. This man is just. And he said it several times to the Jews, very public declaration, said as well that Herod found no fault with him. And so because he has declared him just, innocent, not deserving of death, his ultimate condemnation of him was in fact illegal. Because Jesus is still a Jew, he's not a Roman citizen. Not too many people are going to get bent out of shape about it. Pilate still has a fairly free hand to do what he wants. But technically, he acquitted Jesus the first time he says, this man is a just man. He publicly pronounced it. That should have been the end of it. And so now, in Matthew 27, verse 15, we read, now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing to the multitude one prisoner whom they wished. And at the time, they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. Now, I mentioned last week a little bit of the crimes that Barabbas committed. Does anybody remember what those were? He was a robber. He was a murderer. Yeah, he was an insurrectionist. He tried to raise a rebellion against Rome. So it seems as if he's the leader of a band of criminals who have revolted against Rome and tried to stir up revolt against Rome. In the course of that insurrection, they committed murder. And the general understanding is it's not just they fought Roman soldiers and killed Roman soldiers in that conflict, but they also either killed just regular Roman citizens or what is more likely is they killed some of the Jewish people. That seems to be the sense of a murderer as used of Barabbas. We can't say that definitely, but that's the understanding that I think is commonly held. So Barabbas is absolutely no friend of Israel. Even though he's trying to raise a revolt against Rome, stirring up a revolt against Rome is going to bring the weight of the Roman Empire down on Israel. It's going to end badly for Israel. And the Jewish leaders, the Caiaphas, the high priest, the Sanhedrin, recognize that. They understood that. And so this man Barabbas is, in many respects, Pilate is offering to them the least desirable criminal that he can find. This is the one that all reason says, leave him in jail, crucify him. He's a guy that needs to go away, otherwise it's going to be bad for the whole country. And so, verse 17, it says, therefore, when they had gathered together, Pilate said to them, whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ? For he knew that they had handed him over because of envy. While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, have nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him. But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. So now we are outside the praetorium. They're still not going into Pilate's home or his courtyard at all. They're outside of that. Pilate is probably speaking to them from essentially a balcony overlooking the area outside his home. The chief priests and elders, which would be the Sanhedrin, persuaded who? There in verse 20. There's a large crowd of people outside the walls of Pilate's palace. They are now involved in this whole process. So at this time of the year, because this was the Passover season, the population of Jerusalem exploded. So there are literally hundreds of thousands of people in and around the city of Jerusalem at this point in time. And so the place would have been absolutely jam-packed with people. And it's easy to see how they would get a large multitude there outside of Pilate's palace. And so the chief priest and the Sanhedrin persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. So the governor answered and said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" They said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "What then shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" Now, Pilate is showing he has some recognition of what's going on, of who this Jesus is, and he is turning back to the Jews their own terminology, because the word Christ, does anybody know what it means? Yeah, Messiah. And so Pilate is saying, this Jesus is called your Messiah. He's the one that you've been wanting, supposedly. And they said to him, "Let him be crucified." Then the governor said, "Why? What evil has he done?" Again, there's a declaration of his innocence. "You still haven't told me anything that justifies executing him." And so their response to them was a very reasonable, rational, legal presentation. "Let him be crucified." They just begin to, really, on the verge of rioting is what's going on. There is no argument here. There is no discussion of legal principles. They're just shouting for his death. This now is a lynch mob. That's all this is. And so, verse 24, when Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, "I am innocent of the blood of this just person." So he says it twice in this conversation, that Jesus is just. You see to it. And all the people answered and said, "His blood be on us and on our children." And so Pilate claims innocence. Now, he's not innocent. Washing his hands does not remove his responsibility at all. He is still guilty for his part in this. But the Jews there, not just the chief priests and elders, this seems to be the whole crowd, says, "Fine, we'll be responsible. His blood be on us and on our children." So go over to John 19, verse 1, because Pilate's still not done. He's still trying to persuade the Jews to release Jesus. So he releases to them Barabbas, but he takes one more step to try to convince them to let Jesus live, basically. And so verse 1 of John 19, "So then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him. And the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe. Then they said, 'Hail, King of the Jews,' and struck him with their hands." How many of you have seen that movie, The Passion of the Christ? So many of you have. If you've seen the movie, you've seen a vivid depiction of this scourging. And I'm not going to get into the details of what it is. And you can find that online very easily. There's a lot of good information out there about it. It was a brutal form of punishment. It, by itself, could be used as a form of capital punishment. If the scourging went on long enough, it would kill someone. And so on top of the scourging, you have now the mockery. So the Roman soldiers say, "Hail, King of the Jews." And I can picture this. You get a group, especially a group of soldiers, Roman soldiers. They are the authority of the empire. They are also the means by which the empire has been expanded. So they have every reason to be absolutely arrogant. Because if something happens to any one soldier, they know they have the support of Rome behind them, defending them. And so that they really can call on entire garrisons of troops to come support them in whatever they happen to be doing. This is the winning army. Now they are dealing with a member of one of their subjugated races, which is also a particularly troublesome group of people who generally seem to have been despised just as a people group. They were not well liked. And now Jesus comes along, and the soldiers have been hearing the accusations. Certainly, at least some of them have been there the whole time. Somebody was standing guard over Jesus the entire time that he would have been carried back and forth and tried and interviewed by Pilate. So there's always going to be at least one or two soldiers there who've heard all the goings-on, have heard Jesus' responses, have heard the crowd's accusations, and so now they have this opportunity to do what probably seemed to them to be absolutely hilarious. To take this one that they scorn and put a purple robe on him, the sign of royalty, to make a crown for him. Any of you ever seen the thorns in the Middle East? They are huge, toothpick-like thorns. And so we picture little rose thorns, which would be annoying enough and would certainly be very painful. But they are taking these nasty thorns and they're driving this crown of thorns onto his head, and they begin to mock him by showing him reverence, by scorning him, by bowing before him and saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." That very sarcastic adulation. And they, again, I can picture a group of soldiers, and we don't know how many this was. It may have been a squad. It may have been a little bit larger than that. But there's at least four soldiers there, probably more, who are engaged in this mockery. And I can picture them thinking, this is the funniest thing there is, the best thing they have done in a long time. And they're taking great delight in mocking Jesus. And so, of course, they beat him. And then Pilate takes Jesus back out. Verse 4, Pilate then went out again and said to them, "Behold, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no fault in him." Then Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Again, that movie is actually probably the best images that we come up with, because we're not typically exposed to the type of brutality that Jesus endured. And so if you've seen that movie and you have that image of Jesus there up on the balcony with the crown of thorns and the robe on him, his face beaten and bloodied, he is just really a ruined figure of a man. He is obviously abused, severely abused. At this point in time, he has suffered severe physical trauma. As almost certainly his body is going into shock, because of both the blood loss and just the fatigue and the suffering of the night. And so that he is standing there. Really, I don't think we can picture him standing there as a bold warrior defying everybody. I think if we really recognize the situation here, he is exhausted and physically just has almost no strength left, so that he can probably barely stand. So he is stooped. He is bloody. He is ready to fall over. And Pilate says, "Look at him." That's what he says. "Behold the man. Look at him. Is this not enough?" I mean, I think that's really the question that Pilate's asking. Is this not enough? I have scourged him unjustly. He doesn't deserve it. He has suffered abuse at your hands, at the hands of Herod, now at the hands of Pilate's own soldiers. Look at him. And their response, verse 6, "When the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, 'Crucify him, crucify him.' Pilate said to them, 'You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him.'" He says it again. "The Jews answered him and said, 'We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God.'" This catches Pilate's attention, and he takes him back in. And I will say, I'm taking this in this order. It's possible that the details of John and Matthew are interwoven. So this all may be at the same time that the release of Barabbas was going on. These interviews, you know, I'm breaking them out into several different ones where we see him going back and forth and back and forth. It may not be quite that much. But for our sake of understanding what's going on, I want us to look at them individually. So verse 8, Pilate, when he heard that, he was the more afraid, and he went again in the praetorium and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" And John, this is the second interview with Pilate. It's the second private one. Back in John 18, Pilate first says, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And then he asks Jesus, "What have you done?" And then Jesus tells him, "If my kingdom was of this world, my people would fight for me, but it's not." So Pilate says to him, "Are you a king then?" And the last question Pilate asked him in that interview was, "What is truth?" I think he's mocking him. It's just dismissive. "What is truth? I don't care." And he takes him back out to see the crowd. And so now with this interview, he says to him, "Where are you from?" Jesus does not answer him. Verse 10, Pilate said to him, "Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and power to release you?" In verse 11, Jesus says, you can have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Pilate's threatening Jesus with threats that really, they make no difference to Jesus. Pilate says, I've got power over you. And Jesus says, your power is delegated. Your power comes from God, which just as an aside, that's exactly what Romans 13 said. The powers that be are ordained of God, so that we look at the governments, whatever position that is held, whatever government it is, that government is exercising delegated authority. They do not have final authority. They have authority, but it is not the ultimate authority. It is given to them by God. And ultimately, we go back to Romans 13, there's a purpose for their having that authority. They are sure to do certain things. But we have to recognize, as we view our government, both aspects of that. There is legitimate authority, God-given authority, assigned to every government official. But that authority is delegated, not ultimate. So that they have our allegiance and our obedience, but they do not have our final allegiance and obedience. That's where we see Acts, when the disciples say we ought to obey God rather than man. Because they understood that there is an authority higher than the earthly authority. And that's the gist of what Jesus is telling Pilate here, is that Pilate, you're not the ultimate authority here. There's someone else who has a higher authority. There's also, I think in this particular context, I think Jesus is also pointing to the fact that there is a higher purpose, a higher plan at work than just the scheming of the Jews. Now, I get that mostly from reading Acts back into this, but I think it's certainly reasonable to conclude from what Jesus is saying is that he is reminding Pilate that there's not only a higher authority, there's a higher plan. But he goes on and says, therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin. And part of what Jesus says there is the one that has delivered me has the greater sin. If there is a greater sin than Pilate's, what does that mean about Pilate? He was still sinning. Yeah. Pilate has sinned. There may be one who is more guilty, but Pilate is still guilty. He still bears responsibility for his part in this. So that's why I said back, talking about Pilate washing his hands, he can't wash away his responsibility. He can't abdicate that. It is his responsibility to respond as a just governor, and he's not done that. But there is one who has more guilt. Now, sometimes we read this verse, and I know some have read this and thought, well, you know, the one who delivered Jesus to Pilate, because again, the book of Acts says that Christ was crucified according to the determined knowledge of God. The predetermined plan of God was that Christ would be crucified. And so some have read this verse and said, well, then it's talking about God. God determined and delivered Jesus over to the Jews and Pilate so that he would be crucified. Now, from that verse, verse 11, what's the problem with that conclusion? Why is it wrong to say, in this case, in that verse, God is the one who delivered Jesus to Pilate? Exactly. God cannot be more guilty of something because he does not sin. So it cannot be speaking about God's plan, but rather man's rebellion against God. And now we have various questions about, well, who that is. Well, let me ask this. Who do you think it is? Okay, Judas. Anybody have another opinion? Caiaphas. Those are the two very popular ones. We can argue well for both of them. Ultimately, it doesn't change the truth that's being made, is that there is one who delivered him, wickedly delivered Jesus into the hands of Pilate. That one is guilty. And of course, we know that Judas is guilty. Caiaphas is guilty. The Sanhedrin is guilty. The Jewish mob is guilty. So whoever Jesus is speaking of here is guilty, and he has the greater guilt because of their wicked intent. But verse 12, from then on, Pilate sought to release him. So Pilate continues to seek to release him, but the Jews cried out. And now they strike a nerve. Up to this point in time, Pilate, I think, has been more annoyed than anything. He's not really that concerned about the Jews and Jesus even. He just kind of wants this off his plate. But he doesn't really want to go through the process or the hassle of having this guy crucified. He knows that Jesus doesn't deserve crucifixion, so he's legitimately trying to keep him from that. But at the same time, I think he more or less doesn't care. He's going through, this is his official function. He has to do these things. But now they strike a nerve. So the Jews cried out, verse 12, if you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar. This is an astounding accusation from the Jews, because now they have jumped up and said, we're all for Roman government. And I know Pilate knows the history of Israel. He knows better. And yet at the same time, in their accusation is a veiled threat, or not so veiled threat, because they have caused trouble before for Pilate and for other governors over Judea, because they write letters to Caesar. And they write letters to Caesar saying, this is what this governor has done. And Caesar is certainly interested in keeping the people quiet. He doesn't want an uprising in any of his provinces, because then he has to send troops over there and it becomes a big hassle and he can't expand his territory, or he can't focus on whatever party he's particularly going to this week. It's a nuisance to have to quell an uprising. And so if they write a letter to Caesar accusing Pilate of siding with a traitor against Rome, Caesar's not going to respond well to that. And again, he's not really going to be concerned with justice. There's not going to be this hearing, and they're not going to have all the evidences brought out. And the likely thing is that Caesar is going to remove Pilate, because that's the easiest thing to do, and there's somebody waiting right there to give him a lot of money to put him in that position that Pilate had. So it's to Caesar's advantage just to summarily dismiss Pilate, maybe send him to exile, maybe bring him back home and appoint him over something else. But it's going to end badly for Pilate, almost certainly going to end badly, if he does not do something about this. And so Pilate there, verse 13, when he heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and sat down in a judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Now it was the preparation day of the Passover, in about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, behold your king. Now let me make one comment here about the timing, because it seems as if the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke and the Gospel of John are actually using two different measurements or way of measuring time. So the Matthew, Mark, and Luke seem to be using the more Jewish way of measuring time, which began basically with daylight. And then John is using what seems to be the Roman measure of time, which begins around midnight. So this is probably 6 o'clock in the morning or somewhere in that area. And I have to say, they don't have digital watches. They don't have a standardized time where you can type time.com on the internet and go get exactly the right time for his time zone. And so the time is solar. And so there really is, you know, I look at the sun and I know what time it is. You can usually be fairly accurate. I know somebody that's well practiced in it is more accurate, but it's still, it's not to the minute. And that's certainly not the concern, is being to the minute. So I don't want us to read this as this is 6 a.m. This is around 6 hours after midnight. And so that's just an aside. So verse 14, Pilate now says to the Jews, behold your king. He's telling them again, look at him. And I think he's also mocking them and saying, you said he's your king. You said he claimed to be your king. Look at your king. And I think he's also, with that mockery, is saying, and this is also what's going to happen to anybody who threatens to rise up and revolt against Rome. I'm convinced he's using Jesus as an object lesson to the Jews and saying, if you try to revolt, this will be your end. You can expect nothing better than what Jesus got. But they cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? The chief priest answered, we have no king but Caesar. Then he delivered him to be crucified, and they took Jesus and led him away. So there we have the end of Jesus' trial. All throughout these trials, it is obvious that Jesus has done nothing deserving of death. There are the repeated declarations that he is just. He is a righteous man. But despite all of that, the wickedness, the jealousy, the hatred of the Jewish leaders, the indifference and injustice of the Roman authorities results in Jesus being mocked, beaten, scourged, and now condemned. This is the response of those who hate God. It is shocking that they would be this cruel to someone who was absolutely righteous. And yet at the same time, we read the history of Christianity. You read the stories of those who have been persecuted and martyred for Christ. And the cruelty of man, the hatred of men to those who follow Christ, it's indescribable. And literally, I'm not going to describe it for you. if you want to know what it's like, there are a lot of resources out there. You can read and discover the terrible things people have done to others. But I'm not going to repeat them, certainly not in this setting. Some of them are vile as well as cruel. And yet that's what men do when they are confronted with the righteousness of God. Because what we're now talking about is not just a difference of opinion on what our preferences are about sports or where we live or things like that. These aren't even differences of opinion of whether capitalism or socialism is a better form of economics. This is a refusal to heed the word of God. This is ultimately the satanic response to the holiness of God, so that we see it in the very beginning. Genesis chapter 3, we have one man who does what is pleasing to God, the other does not. And the other, when he sees that his works are not pleasing to God, he does not go and say, well, how can I do better? What can I do that would be pleasing to God? He goes to the one who pleases God and says, I can't have this. You deserve to die. And he murders him. So that we have Cain killing Abel, not over differences of better farming techniques, but over worship. One is accepted of God, and his very obedience to God is an offense to the one who rebels against. And the response is, you must die. And then that continues for all of human history. I would say ultimately it's a hatred of God. And I think we actually would trace it back deeper than just, I hate the person. But it's a hatred of God. And in my hatred of God, I'm going to lash out at that one who bears the image of God. This one who is now acting in obedience to God. Because I despise God, I'm going to destroy the reflector of God. There's a foolishness in that, in being unable to see that by destroying the image bearer of God, the one who is doing what is right, they're doing two things that are empty and pointless. Number one, they can't stop the plan of God. And it's been said repeatedly that the life of the church is watered by the blood of the martyrs. It's through the death of thousands that the church is multiplied to millions. And the other thing they're doing is they do not recognize by destroying the one who is obedient to God, reflecting the truth of God and the holiness of God to them, they are destroying one of the avenues that God uses to bring them to himself. So they're actually destroying a means of repentance that God has given to them. They are hindering their own salvation by their destruction of the righteous. So it is an absolutely foolish thing they do. But sin doesn't ever make men smarter. Many of you know Ted Joles. He says it very simply. Sin makes you stupid. And that's exactly what we're talking about with all of this.